Everyone, now this session will begin by this program. So the first speaker can start. So the first speaker is Ms. Chan Van Kalar. She is a senior lecturer in Faculty of Law. Rodham's University. So our topic is the role and duty of religious institution in civil society. So we will begin by her, Mr. Helen.
Thank you so much.
Hello.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for being here. This is a little bit of a new direction that my research is taking. So at the end of the presentation, I really appreciate some feedback. And unfortunately, in this 15 minutes or 20 minutes, there's quite a lot of information that I would have liked to address. And unfortunately, I will focus on a very limited aspect of this topic. But like I said, I would appreciate some feedback afterwards, or maybe some suggestions for feedback. I'm going to focus today on religious institutions in civil society, and also, like I said, a very limited aspect of that. But I think it's generally accepted that not only an organized but also an active society is important for inclusive democracy and development. Various forms of community organizations exist, and the most important characteristic that they have in common is that they do not form part of the state. The emphasis is therefore not on commercial or profit organizations, but on non-governmental or non-profit organizations that make a contribution to the society at large, and it's then within this category that we also find churches and religious organizations. Focus of this paper, when it comes to things like state funding, does that necessarily mean interference in the affairs of the organization and a possible infringement of autonomy of these organizations? And also, should churches see and organize themselves in the same way as other NGOs in order to play a role in civil society? This paper will seek to illustrate the importance of churches and religious organizations as stakeholders in participatory governance. And religious organizations, I think, carry out quite a substantial support function that are beyond the capacity of the state, and they play an important role in the socioeconomic development of people. I think these institutions can cooperate with the state without compromising their religious identity. And I think in a constitutional democracy with guaranteed freedom of religion, there should be cooperation between the state and all religious communities. So while definitions of civil society remain contested, the sector is broadly understood as occupying the space between the state, the market, and the family, often referred to as the voluntary sector, and in South Africa, the non-profit sector. Civil society organizations, it includes non-governmental organizations, community-based organizations, faith-based organizations. And in terms of South Africa, the sector is usually referred to as a non-profit sector, comprising non-profit organizations, and they, in the South African context, registered in terms of the South African Non-Profit Organization Act. In general, churches and religious organizations function as voluntary associations in civil society, either as churches and congregations in support and development of religious convictions and practices, or as faith-based community or service organizations. Faith-based organizations are often non-profit organizations that are involved in some or other form of service delivery, including religious education, charity, elderly care, health services, and missionary work. I think it's activities that in evil times would have come primarily within the jurisdiction of the church rather than the state. Many of these organizations have religious objectives, either to provide religious education or to be involved in missionary work. Some of them are funded by churches or congregations to run religious schools or old age homes, and some have no religious objectives at all, but are inspired by religious values. What makes religious institutions necessarily different? I think supporters of the expanded role of faith-based organizations point out that religious organizations provide moral guidance, teach individual responsibility, and provide a framework for individual transformation that is often absent in secularized human services programs. As Lusky notes, the successful anti-poverty pushes in American history have been religiously based. They've worked on the inside by changing hearts and not just temporarily changing habits. Faith-based organizations have mobilized committed groups of volunteers who are motivated by religious concerns and the belief that they are doing God's work. Religious beliefs and participation in organized religion provide the motivations and the social ties that result in higher levels of donating time and money to a variety of organizations, both secular and religious. Public funding often requires religious organizations to conform to reporting and other requirements that can contribute to faith-based organizations to become more secularized when they become dependent on public funds. There was an interesting study in America that looked at four faith-based AIDS organizations in New York City, trying to determine what impact the dependence of public funds had on the spiritual values and mission of these organizations. It seemed that all four organizations valued and honored their religious roots, but the original meaning of religion changed. Two of these organizations actually became secularized. Some of these organizations even underwent a name change based on a need to expand public recognition and attract private donors and stakeholders. The question also is that what makes faith organizations, what is the characteristics of faith-based organizations which distinguish them or maybe offer any added value from secular ones? There's a couple of common approaches to the constructing the relationship between faith and the voluntary sector. If we look at the first model there, it's a typical model where the distinctive characteristics of religious organizations are assumed to be kind of insignificant for policy purposes. It's evidenced by sometimes a lack of recognition and even indications of discrimination against the religion in general or the specific religion or organization. Emerging from the research, even statements made by authorities saying that we will fund religious organizations but not religious activity. There have been many accusations that politics and prejudice have been directly applied to prevent specific religious groups from being funded. There's a more widespread feeling that failure by the authorities to recognize the distinctive features of a religious ethos have led to indirect discrimination, whereby religious groups have been asked to jump through hoops to compromise their principles in order to be funded. A second model recognizes that religious organizations and faith-based groups have distinctive characteristics and should be treated under special provisions or even specific legislation, and therefore giving a due regard to the right to freedom of religion. It is therefore also argued that religious groups are likely to favor such an approach because it raises their status by recognizing their existence and to a greater, or even maybe a lesser extent, their autonomy. One example relates to education and the role and position of faith-based schools. Interestingly, in the UK you'll see that there's quite a growing commitment to diversity in education that has also allowed government to positively encourage faith-based schools. And maybe two examples, since we are dealing with religion in African context, two examples that quite recently popped up in the case of Ghana and in Nigeria. In Ghana, we can see that there's been a partnership framework between the government, churches, and other faith-based organizations, which has been launched in September 2012, in order to facilitate ways of improving the quality of education in Ghana. Over the years, the government of Ghana and the religious bodies have been in partnership arrangement, which allows religious bodies to manage their schools, while the government pays teachers and provides the infrastructure and teaching and learning materials. A number of schools established by a religious body has opened access to more children of school-going age in Ghana, and almost 50% of basic schools have been set up by the religious bodies and other organizations. The church and government have been partners in education, and there's a need for the government to respect the church partnership role by removing the obstacles in the way of the churches to manage their schools, so that the church partnership role, by so that this church can actually contribute to morality, discipline, and excellence in schools. In Nigeria, we can see that a partnership has been established between the government, the church, and other genuine stakeholders, and it's been described as an essential turnaround of the country's education sector. According to Archbishop, investing effectively in education in Nigeria is an imperative. He declared that partnership between government and voluntary agencies, especially the church, worked very well in Nigeria in the past. According to the Archbishop, motivated by a patriotic desire to give the best to the children of this country, he desired the revival of sincere partnership in education between government and genuine private managers of education. Also, even according to the President, the administration will continue to raise the standards and increase quality in education by encouraging public partnership investment in the education sector. I will review that the church and other religious groups must be encouraged to continue the interface between government and the people as mediator, as partners, as counselor, and ultimately as conscience of society. They must continue to be positive tools for national progress, not agents of conflicts. Teaching must advance the cause of humanities and social justice and must strengthen the resolve of people to be better citizens and encourage government to do that, which is good in the eyes of God and men. However, in an increasingly plural society, it's much more difficult to construct a separate faith sector in relation to voluntary action and social welfare. Also maybe for the fear of provoking conflict where there's support or maybe perceived favoritism for a particular religion or religious group. Then the third model focuses on, or actually suggests that individuals should undertake their social action immersed in the structures of a wider society and encourages individuals to play roles as active citizens in a range of secular settings according to their calling and vocation. It allows for voluntary and community organizations to have an explicit or implicit religious foundation and value, but also be open to the wider community. It might work in relation to providing certain social services, but maybe not in others like faith schools, where the religious ethos and tradition plays quite an important role. What is the role of religious organizations in civil society? Well, firstly, we look at the provision of services. So kind of service-driven organization, where religious organizations play an important role in providing social services. But we also find organization which is sometimes seen as the social watchdog of government. Your human rights advocacy and monitoring organizations established there to influence policy. I think in South Africa, many civil society organizations are filling the gaps by providing socio-economic and basic services that the state is unable to provide, and in some cases have even taken over the functions of the state. These organizations are often more able to meet the needs of poor communities as they can be more flexible and are able to identify creative and innovative development alternatives. They provide not only qualitative benefits for the state, though their roles in relationships and service delivery for development, but also financial benefits. While the benefits of these state-SEO partnerships are well demonstrated, there seems to be a perception among some within government that they are only an irritant. According to the Non-Profit Organisation Act in South Africa, the Act specifically explicitly states that within the limits prescribed by law, every organ of state must, not may, must determine and coordinate the implementation of its policies and measures in a manner designed to promote, support and enhance the capacity of non-profit organisations to perform their functions. Quite a lot of challenges that hinders the performance of organizations to perform their functions. And I'm going to focus a little bit more on the aspect of funding, and we'll get to some of the other challenges as well. You can see there, according to Archbishop Desmond Tutu, charity organizations, which represent 30% of the social services in the country, have $3 billion less to spend on the crucial causes because of the recession. 500,000 needy South Africans, many of them women and children, have been plunged into despair as the country's charities battle with hunger crisis. Question, challenge, often pops up when you talk about funding, is what about the independence of that specific organisation? You'll see the availability of new funds, the ways they're provided, and the demand for accountability that must come with them certainly have the potential to cause goal displacement and mission drift, loss of independence, vitality, and an erosion of the separation of church and state for both congregations and religious service agencies as governments seek to use these organizations to pursue public policy agendas. You'll see there, according to the South African Council of Churches, They are of the view that any voluntary association, including religious organizations, will qualify for public funds if they provide a service to the public, or at least a section of the public. And therefore, you will see, according to them, the association that admits any person who subscribes to and supports its aims and objectives can be classified as an open association and should be entitled to public funding. If an organization's objectives are regarded to be constitutionally permissible goals, they should be eligible to apply for state funding. And then the state is precluded from denying funding to that body solely because it disapproves of its policies, practices, or activities. So the African civil society is currently facing a funding crisis. This has resulted in a multiplicity of sustainability and institutional development challenges. And reasons for these circumstances include declining international funding, leadership, and identity changes, and the apparent unwillingness of government to meet its responsibilities to the sector. Government has been particularly remiss about its obligations regarding legislated and budgeted resource flows to these organizations. And as a result of the above, the state's sustainability of many important NPOs is seriously compromised, a situation that has been exacerbated by the prevailing economic recession. Interesting case that was delivered in the Free State High Court, which is quite an implication for the state's duty to support financially non-profit organizations, was the case of National Association of Welfare Organizations and Non-Governmental Organizations within the MEC Social Development Free State. And why this case is quite important is because the Free State policy resembles the national policy. Therefore, the implications for the Free State policy also affects the national funding policy. In 2010, the Free State High Court delivered judgment in this particular case, which recognizes the significant contribution by non-profit organizations to the provision of statutory service in South Africa. The judgment affirms the responsibility of government to offer financial support to organizations that render statutory services and provides guidelines on how the responsibility between the state and NPO should be shared in order to prevent the state from abdicating its constitutional and statutory powers. The judgment relates to the court application brought by the National Association of Welfare Organizations and Non-Governmental Organizations, NABONGO, Dutch Reformed Social Services Free State and Free State Care in Action, and was brought against the MEC for Social Development, the Head of Social Development, the National Minister of Social Development. And these three NPOs brought this court application after several years of serious frustration about the way in which the department dealt with subsidies to NPOs. The frustration arose, among others, from delays in payments, failures of the department to consult with them and inform them as to how much it would pay them for the services that they deliver. Equally importantly, the frustration arose from the fact that the transfers are too small. The NPOs are thus unavailable to deliver the services which they are willing and able to deliver and which they know are badly needed by poor and vulnerable people in the province. According to the judgment, about 1,400 NPOs are currently funded by the Free State Department of Social Development, and the department actually acknowledges that these organizations play a major role in delivering social services to children, older people, people with disabilities, and the department is dependent on these NPOs for delivering services with the department in terms of various roles. The judgment signifies the recognition of the major contribution which the non-profit sector is making to the provision of welfare services in South Africa. And although the judgment does not deeply explore the importance of the NPOs in the welfare system, it's worth pointing out that in addition to the complementing the financial resources which the state expends in welfare services, the NPOs contribute their human capital, professional expertise, and their infrastructure. The effect of the judgment is that the department is confronted with the reality that the full extent of statutory services beyond the capacity of NPOs, and this will force the department to assume responsibility for what exceeds the ability of the NPOs. Now if you look at the, according to the South African Council of Churches, allocation of state funding should depend on the following criteria. Does the voluntary association seek to achieve an objective that is either directly or indirectly protected by the Constitution? The extent to which the organization seeks to improve the quality of life and free the potential of all people by contributing to the progressive realization of socio-economic rights, the nature, the purpose and objectives of the organization, the benefit it actually confers on the community it serves and the broader South African society, The extent to which the organization addresses disadvantages arising from past patterns of discrimination and competing priorities in respect of budgetary allocations. There's quite a lot of other challenges facing these institutions, which unfortunately is outside the scope of this presentation, but just briefly on the aspect of monitoring and accountability, just in the South African context, I think the Auditor General, unfortunately, has been a little bit dissatisfied for the past 6 years with the Department of Social Development's non-monitoring of NGOs. It has been his view that the department does not know where the money given to these organizations go. The NGO Act makes it clear that the department had to notify organizations in writing before deregistration or marking of non-compliant, which in fact did not happen. So apart from the procedural aspects, which we won't focus on now, but in 2012, 85,000 NGOs were registered and once deregistered or found to be non-compliant. These NGOs are unable to now access government or lottery funding and are unable to provide essential welfare services. As a result of the mass deregistrations, large donors wanted to cease funding NGOs. New systems like this one, which allow for better monitoring of organizations, which in itself I think is quite important, must however be lawfully implemented without compromising the provision of basic services. Regulation and support must act in tandem. An interesting report in the UK in 2013 indicated that the state is increasingly paying religious groups to deliver local welfare crisis services. And almost a fifth of English councils have given cash to faith-based charities to run food banks, healthcare, counselling, etc. Some authorities are actually transferring large sums of money to church organisations, and religious groups are beginning to play an important role in the provision of these welfare services. There was an interesting divergence of reported views within the church as to whether it was right for the church to accept state funds in this way, or whether the delivery of cashless welfare was either appropriate or effective. According to one view, so much of education and health, welfare reform started in the church. And I think that the church has got the mindset and the mandate to be able to deliver exactly what the community needs. Other churches also receiving statutory funding needed to protect their Christian ethos, guard against mission drift, because they are following the money, and to hold in tension the responsibility to both care for the poor and challenge government policy. I think what we've learned from the Sahonga case as well is that statutory service, and we can include various other services in that, depend on the non-profit sector. The NPO's provision of quite a lion's share of essential services indicates that government not only collaborates with these NPOs, but relies heavily on them and their financial and human resources to discharge a substantial part of its statutory duties. Just by looking at the Free State, 40% of statutory services in the Free State are provided by NPOs. In these circumstances, the collapse of the non-profit organization due to the insufficient funding might lead to the implementation of various statutory provisions coming to a halt and to the deprivation of essential services and those who depend on them. I think the judgment also indicates that when such organizations provide services which fall within the constitutional statutory obligations of the government, provided that the NPO satisfies certain law requirements, the state has the responsibility to design and to apply a fair, equitable and transparent system of financial support for these organizations, albeit within the state's available resources. In the interest of human rights, freedom of religion, and general freedom of association, and for the sake of preserving the autonomy of civil society as a whole, any democratic society will need to allow space for people of faith to organize, operate, and provide welfare from their own resources as they see fit. The state should not need to intrude on the religious life of its citizens. The tension between NPOs partnering with government and those wanting maybe to retain distance to ensure their independence remains. Organizations likely to forge partnerships with government tend to work in the fields of health, social welfare, and education. And maybe sometimes NPOs working towards democratic and political objectives are less likely to have close links with government. With a global recession and increased reliance by NPOs on government funding, it remains to be seen how the terrain will shift in the next few years. Churches and congregations are among the most important of non-profit public benefit organizations. The more they operate in the public sphere and are dependent on public funds, the more the need for accountability, but also the potential for a loss of independence and vitality. If this is not taken seriously, it can lead to the erosion of the separation of church and state, and to the interference by the state in the internal organization of religious organizations in order to pursue their own public policy agenda. Thank you.
Excellent conclusion. It is all time. So we have 5 minutes to question, comment, and answer. So one or two main points to be asked. Okay.
Would you agree to protect the sphere of merging and or the independence of the churches or the charitable institutions, that we should encourage government to tax the people less and allow money to stay with the people?
Well, when it comes to money, I think the word problematic, but
I think that's the main problem, that if it's one thing to try and treat the symptoms in society, but we've got to get to the cause. Where is all the problem happening? And we've got to entrust the finances to people that are people of character, capacity, and have a comprehension of what to do. And at the moment we have too much money going through government, and there's very little in the pockets of the local people to help themselves and to help them.
It's interesting that the non-profit organization for Equal Education, which is quite a prominent NPO in South Africa that's actually contributed quite substantially to challenge government on providing of textbooks, and was one of the institutions that was actually deregistered by the department, regarded to be administered police or whatever, but the situation is that some of these NPOs provide substantial services, and I think it's also government being a little bit wary of private organizations, because then you don't have that kind of authority over private institutions. And I think when you're dealing with religious organizations, that might be different, because inherently in religious organizations there's this commitment to providing a service. But then government gets lazy, and more of these duties, which rest of the government, is just being given to these organizations without the necessary funding.
To kind of a paradox, yeah. Thank you, Helen. I don't have time. Okay, thank you. Give appreciation to Helen.